Hello, and welcome to What We Just Watched from TV Cream. I'm Chris.
And I'm Ian, and in today's edition of the programme, we're going to start with my choice of viewing. Okay, so this programme, Chris, I think you're not going to have any difficulty in identifying what it is. However, it's from a point in this programme's history that is perhaps not as well known as others, which means you might need a little bit of time to work out. But I don't know.
Okay,
Anyway, here we go.
So we've got a Granada TV front cap.
Indeed.
Which could be any number of things. We've got a number of... Oh, well, I can tell you now. We're watching a very early incarnation of the Krypton Factor.
Well done.
I'm really, really excited about this. What we've seen, like, lava exploding and all sorts of kind of natural phenomena.
Very dramatic images.
It doesn't exactly say television's toughest quiz, but I'm really excited.
Excellent. Well, I'll pause it there because we're about to learn the contestants. It is indeed an episode of the Krypton Factor, and we'll come back and tell you about it afterwards. Growing up in the 1980s, Chris, one of the few reasons to look forward to a Monday was the knowledge that the Krypton Factor was on TV in the evening, which I know you'd agree. And this particular edition, which we've just watched, was shown in September 1982, by which point the programme had been on air for a good 5 years and was firmly established as a regular on the nation's screens. It started in 1977. And I think what this edition shows, above all else, is that 5 years in, it's really established. It's very confident, settled in format. Everything ticks over. It's a very smooth production. Now, the first thing I'm going to ask you about it is, I mentioned it was shown in 1982. It feels to me like this is a show not only of its time, but almost ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Do you think that programmes like The Krypton Factor and other quiz shows were really where the 1980s began on television?
I think you can definitely argue that, especially on the strength of the programme we've just watched. There's a lot of good use of contemporary technology. It feels kind of fresh. It feels... There's something of the laboratory about The Krypton Factor. Yeah. It feels kind of slightly 2001.
Yes, even now, even watching it now. And I think... Well, I have a little theory that quiz shows and panel games around about this time, so that's the Krypton Factor, Play Your Cards Right, blankety-blank, they have the feel of something new. The decade has arrived, in the sense that there's lots of very ostentatious equipment, flashing lights, bits of the set move around.
Yes.
Nothing like that was really going on television at that point in time.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like the 80s began in Quizland before the rest of TV.
I definitely think you're onto something there. And I think the programme we just watched really backs that theory up.
Because what else in 1982 really looked like that?
Exactly, yeah.
You've got lots of shimmering screens.
Well, every contestant has their own screen. I mean, luxury.
Lots of flashing lights.
Yeah.
Lots of bold branding. Bold, bright colours.
Yeah. It's still quite classy, though. Garish, is it? It's not showbiz. It's not traditional light entertainment.
No. The set is as much of a character in the proceedings as the contestants.
I love that set. I really love that set.
Well, it has, for me, the ambience almost of a lecture theatre, but a very well-furnished lecture theatre.
Yeah.
With our host, Gordon Burns.
Good evening, and welcome to the last of the four semi-finals in this year's series of The Krypton Factor. Just one more contestant to find to complete the lineup for next week's grand final.
A sort of firm but fair professor.
Oh, that's a very good description of Gordon, actually.
He's charming when he needs to be.
Yeah.
But he's also stern when he needs to be.
Which is actually what you want, really, from a question master.
Which youth in mythology fell in love with his own reflection in a pool and pined away until he was changed into a flower?
And he is actually a question master rather than a host, isn't he? Or a compere.
That's a good point, yes.
He is the question master.
Narcissus.
Correct, 2 points.
Yes, because there's none of the patter you'd get from a Brucey or a Terry.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things we noticed when we were watching the introduction to the show is the contestants don't introduce themselves. They have no chat with Gordon.
And taking part in our fourth semi-final tonight are Angie Sales, age 23. She's a librarian living in London. She likes athletics, writing and rock music.
They are introduced to us at the start of the show, aren't they, by these little films with almost like a kind of data bank of information about their age and their occupation and their interests. It's almost like the producers have gone, well, that's too convivial, that's too fluffy. What we want are the facts about the contestants, and once we've established the facts, it's on with the game.
And Charlie Riley, 33 years old, a local government officer living in Edinburgh. His interests are sport, music and current affairs.
The whole programme is stripped back to its core elements, which is the quizzing.
Absolutely. It feels like they've taken the blueprint of the quiz show apart and reassembled it in a kind of very kind of modern, streamlined fashion for the 1980s.
One other thing that struck me about this set and the way it's organised is that the audience are positioned quite a way back from the contestants and also from Gordon Burns. They are very hushed. We don't really see them. And apart from their applause, they interact very little with proceedings.
That's true. And we can see that they're there. We can see them behind Gordon, which is actually a hallmark of quite a few Granada quiz shows. I remember Connections used to have that, I think Runway. Had that as well.
Okay. It made me wonder, though, what sort of people would willingly go along to watch The Krypton Factor, and I suspect not the same type of person who would turn up for Family Fortunes or Play Your Cards Right.
I don't think you're getting many coach trips to go and watch The Krypton Factor as you possibly would at Family Fortunes. I tell you who would have been in the audience. It would be people who like crosswords and logic puzzles and that kind of thing.
Who turns up not necessarily to be entertained, but maybe to be stimulated.
Well, you can imagine them playing along with the contestants and maybe kind of a little kind of fist pump of triumph if they got a question that the contestants didn't get.
And afterwards they would be dissecting it and thinking...
Did you get the question in the mental agility?
I got it
straight
making
away.
Making them sound like they're nerds. But there's a fair grain of truth in that.
I think they're a more refined breed of nerd.
But right now, I'm going to wish all the contestants, men and women, the very best of luck, and let battle commence.
Let us come on to the subject of Gordon Burns.
Well, let's.
He is an exemplary presenter of this programme.
Yes.
He's the perfect choice. Now, I don't know personally, I mean, did you grow up in Granada land?
I did grow up in Granada land, so, you know, I'm familiar with Gordon and his wide portfolio.
Because he did other stuff, didn't he?
He presented Granada Reports, I think. He had a very brief career as a football commentator for Granada.
Because he has various functions here, as well as asking the questions, setting the questions.
Yeah.
He has to be a host for us, the viewer.
He has to keep the traffic moving,
yes,
doesn't he? As we said earlier, there's very little patter, but he does have to kind of keep the wheels turning of the show.
But we move on now to a second set of questions. This time they're just that little bit more difficult, still worth 3 points for the right answer.
Perhaps the most striking thing about him is not so much what he does, but what he is sitting behind.
Well, that's extraordinary, isn't it? That is amazing.
Let's describe it. It is a large, sort of three-winged desk.
Yes.
On a revolving podium.
Yes.
Which swings one way and the other, depending on which bit of the programme we're in.
And it's entirely pointless. It's just there because they can have a rotating desk.
But that's not a bad thing.
Well,
it's pointlessness.
I concede. This is the quiz show desk that Stanley Kubrick would have insisted upon.
It is amazing, and it's very much of a piece with the aesthetic of the programme, isn't it? And just like the fact that the contestants, they're not on ordinary chairs, they're on swivel chairs.
Yes.
And they each have those little customised mounted screens.
Yeah.
No expense or detail has been spared.
There is a lot of detail that's gone into the design and the look of the show.
There are five rounds in this edition of The Krypton Factor.
Round one is mental agility.
Did you think this was a bit of a tough one? It's not a very friendly way to start, is it?
I'm going to have... I mean, that's great. It's actually brilliant to have a quiz show which just makes no concession right from the off. It's saying, this show, this quiz is hard.
You're straight in there at the deep end.
Who lives in the house opposite the house with two less windows than the Browns?
And what took me back was the amount of attention that you have to pay to it. And you really have to focus
hard. Extraordinary. And this is at 7 o'clock at night.
How many windows are there in the house opposite the house whose number is three less than its number of windows?
I think, and I might be wrong, that in later years, they amped up the drama here by making the contestants wear headphones. Is that right? Didn't Gordon say something like,
put your headphones on, please, for total concentration?
Like we're in a language lab.
On the party. Well, exactly. And that goes back to what I was saying about lecture theatre and all sort of educational feel to it.
One thing I really loved about that round, and this is a word we've used already, it's very clinical. There are actually passages of silence while Charles Foster, who's the voiceover man, is talking about the houses.
What is the number of the house opposite the house whose number is two less than the house with two more windows than the house directly opposite?
It reminds me a bit of those Granada schools programmes, like Experiment.
Note down this reading using the top scale.
If you switched on that programme, just on the off chance of wanting something to pass the time, you didn't really know what you were going to get, and you saw those questions being asked.
Yeah.
Do you think you would probably then switch off?
In some ways, that's the show saying to some viewers, this isn't really for you.
And then in a great bit of sequencing, we go from that to the assault course, or physical ability. And I always love this, because what would appeal more to a small child than a giant adventure playground?
Yes.
The two ladies start together. On the far side, Joanna Baker from South Wales, in green, and closest to us, London's Angie Sales wearing red.
And watching them falling over, splashing in mud, landing in water.
And they're wearing colour-coded tracksuits.
Of course.
But Angie Sales just in the lead from Joanna Baker. Now Scotland's Charlie Riley is underway.
And I think this was out on the moors. It looks like it's the Lancashire moors somewhere.
It's a bit bleak, isn't it?
But it adds to the, that adds to the feel to it, though, because it's like, right, we've gone...
It's very austere.
We've gone from one...
There's no glamour.
...to the other. And it looks windswept. You've got the military there.
Which, again, amps up the drama. It's not just any old assault course. This is an army assault course.
Absolutely. And it really benefits from having Gordon's commentary on it.
Yeah.
Joanna in a bit of trouble, misses the net, but Bill Bigley is almost up level with her and with Angie Sales.
He makes you engage with it in a whole extra way, because you then start to notice, oh, so-and-so's flagging behind.
He really orientates you as to who's in the lead, who's coming up from the rear, you know, who's in danger of losing the lead.
And at the moment, in that second place is Joanna, with Angie third and Charlie Riley fourth.
Let's not forget the very best element of this, of course, which was...
the zip slide.
Of course.
Bill Bigley prepares to come down the aerial slide. And the electronics engineer who works for British Aerospace, Bill Bigley, well clear, marvellous run as he comes down with just the scramble net to go under.
Who wouldn't want to go on one of them? At any age, child or adult.
I think while we were watching it, Ian, we were kind of talking about the technique you needed right at the end, because there was some mud kind of quite deliberately positioned underneath the zip slide, which could hamper an unwitting slider if they got their footwork wrong.
Well, I always remember, and I learned this from the Krypton Factor, that if you are on one of these slides, keep your legs up.
To emerge, we'll get second place, because it's only two strides to the finish. In fact, it's Joanna Baker. She comes through for second place, Angie third and Charlie fourth.
Then we go back to the studio for the intelligence test.
Yeah.
They each have in front of them a frame with five conveyor belts already in position. They have also been given seven drive belts, which they must use to link the conveyor wheels. If done correctly, then a turn of the drive wheel should set the conveyor system in motion. But that is not all. The Krypton blocks at the top must be placed on the conveyor belt in such a way that when they reach the bottom, they spell out Krypton, reading from left to right as we look at it.
This is my favourite bit of the Krypton Factor.
OK, why?
It's the bit where they've got a big plastic puzzle.
That's it, yes, you're right. And because the whole thing is transparent, they're facing the audience and the cameras, we can see exactly what they get right, but even better, what they get wrong.
Again, this is a product of the great design they had on the Krypton Factor.
What we don't see, and this is deliberate, is the puzzle being solved in real time. And I suspect that it was often the case that it took far longer than the couple of minutes which we see here.
I think you're right. But you wouldn't know that from watching it. It's beautifully edited down to 2.5 minutes or whatever it is.
Well, the first task for the contestants is to work out in which direction each conveyor belt will move.
And helped again by Gordon's commentary.
Again, kind of...
Now, what she doesn't know is that she's done it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's always, the secret with this puzzle is to start at the bottom.
Well, it puts us in the know,
yeah.
And it makes us feel slightly superior.
What are you putting that for? Yeah, that's wrong.
Oh, she's got it all wrong.
You're going to have to start again.
The most difficult part is then to come, which Angie has reached here, and that's with those blocks. They've got to be placed at the top in the right orientation because there are a number of chutes which they have to fall down, like that one there, and they actually turn through 90 degrees when they drop. But
although we hear the commentary, in the studio, this particular round was done in complete silence.
Oh, God, can you imagine, Ian, what it would be like if you were, like, the last person to finish? And, oh, God, you're still barely on the first row.
And the other contestants, Gordon, the audience, the crew, everyone is standing there watching just you, waiting and waiting and waiting. For God's sake, can you not get that cog in the right place?
Top right, and it does. The major side, Bill Bigley, got second place. And with Charlie in so much trouble, it's going to be Joanna third if that end drops, and it does. Third place for Joanna Baker.
The penultimate round is the observation round.
Yes.
And I think this is where things became a little unstuck, I think, for this episode.
Yeah.
Because what we saw was a bit of a rubbish clip. It was from a Disney film.
Well, you say it's a Disney film, Ian. I thought it was a Southern TV children's drama.
Well, there, out of your own mouth, you condemn it. Because
Ian, that could have been the Famous Five.
It looked appalling.
Help! My
We're told by Gordon that it is the Watchers in the Wood.
Right.
Unfortunately, he gets that slightly wrong because it's the Watcher in the Woods. But yeah, it's rubbish.
I mean, as I say, it just looks like a TV drama, doesn't it? There's nothing cinematic
about it. Nothing about it suggests that it's Disney. Betty Davis appears in it, but there's no reference to her.
I haven't left the house all day.
I think it suffers because it's a very loosely realised round, because all they do is they watch this and then Gordon asks them questions about it.
What was the name of the old lady who owned the house?
I thought that was the bit of the show that sagged the most.
Well, yeah, and I wonder whether they came to realise this because the observation round was tinkered with as the 80s went on and improved, I think. Because they started to use some specially recorded bits, didn't they?
They did.
The before and after, and these five things have changed, and celebrity guests. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So, contestants, turn now to your screens, please, and concentrate very hard as we go down under to join Steve Coogan and special guest Lisa Goddard.
There is a sort of a coda to this round, isn't
there?
The identity parade.
Yeah.
So, and I want the contestants to think back to one of those strange happenings. It was when the lorry crashed after one of the horses bolted across in front of it. And it is the lorry driver we want them to identify from this lineup of nine lorry drivers. For two more points, which one was in the film?
Again, it feels like this is sort of flown in from another programme, where you have a lineup of lookalikes who are all meant to be playing, or possibly playing, an extra.
Well, I was going to ask you, Ian, how much bearing do you think being able to pick out an extra from a parade of actors, does that really make you a super person?
Oh, do you think that this is actually a bit below the the exacting standards that we've come to expect? I think you could be right.
And so the final round, general knowledge, and at the end of it, we shall know who goes through to next week's final.
And finally, the general knowledge round, a great way to wrap things up.
Yep.
quickfire questions.
But it's quite emblematic of the crypto factor in that they don't just give you a standard set of general knowledge questions.
In which arts centre is the new London home of the Royal Shakespeare? Charlie.
Barbican.
Correct.
They're kind of interlinked.
Frederick I of Germany's surname was Barbarossa. What does that mean? Charlie.
Redhead.
No, red beard. You lose a point.
They're kind of the themes running through the question.
Who wrote about the Red Cross Knight in his poem The Fairy Queen in the 1590s? Bill.
Edmund Spenser.
Correct.
Which, you know, is actually quite a kind of very kind of torturous thing to actually have to do for the question writer. It just adds that level of detail and care that's gone into that cryptum factor aesthetic we were talking about earlier.
And that's complemented by the way that that round is staged.
Oh, it's beautiful.
With the contestants in a line.
Oh, it's amazing.
Filmed side on.
I know.
And bathed in profile. And it's just picked out in spotlight.
With their score in front
of
them.
Yeah, so we can see.
A digital readout.
We can see these scores and how they're doing. They presumably have no idea, unless they've been keeping score in their head, how they are doing.
And they probably are.
But yeah, we, again, I kind of feel slightly superior. We've got the upper hand. We can survey the progress of them. And we think, oh no, if only they do, oh no, he's not going to do it, oh. And so that just adds another layer of.
Well, also, don't they get deducted a point if they get a question
wrong?
Oh,
that's very cruel, yeah.
So we don't actually get it in this episode, but you could actually have someone kind of racing a far ahead and then they get a bit cocky and then someone just pips them because they get a few questions wrong.
And so it's all over, and the winner tonight with a Krypton factor of 38 is Merseyside's Bill Bigley.
At the very, very end, when the winner is announced, there's a little bit of a sense of that things have been relaxed slightly. The rules are loosened because the audience are tittering.
Ties are metaphorically being loosened.
Well, the contestants start kissing each other.
A couple of them.
Well, and the winner puts his hand rather awkwardly on one of the woman's knees.
From Bristol, John Webley, and of course from my girl, Bill Bigley, tonight's winner. And in the meantime now, from all tonight's semi-finalists and from myself, good night.
And he also ends up with a big bit of lipstick on his cheek from one of the women and who reciprocate with a big kiss. And I think the programme would not have suffered from losing this sequence. I think when you realised that it was the Krypton Factor that we were watching, you might have expected a different signature.
Well, the Krypton Factor is one of those shows that began with a theme tune that probably is forgotten now. It's this kind of twiddly electronic piece of music.
And the piece of music, we should say, is written by Mike Moran.
Yes.
He of Rock Bottom.
Where are we? Rock Bottom.
The UK's 1977 Eurovision Song Contest entry, which came second.
It's not a very tuneful piece of music, is it?
It's no tune.
It's not one that you'd be whistling happily after the show.
Unlike the piece of music which came next, which I think is far more memorable and is probably the one that most people associate with the Krypton
Factor. I think you're right.
Which is. What role do you think the Krypton Factor played for ITV in terms of the family of programmes?
Well, I imagine they saw it as a programme that could draw in a different sort of audience. I imagine there was a lot of talk about ABC Ones when they were commissioning this show. As I mentioned earlier, it's a show that would kind of draw in kind of crossword enthusiasts and people like that. Possibly people who read a broadsheet newspaper and possibly weren't natural ITV viewers. But there was enough in there to attract a larger audience than that. It's quite pacey, it's attractive to watch, it's exciting to watch. So in that sense, it probably worked really well for ITV.
I think it was also something that ITV could use whenever its critics moaned about ITV being too frivolous or too lowbrow.
Yeah.
It was very handy to have it in the schedules.
Oh, absolutely.
To point to and say, well, look at, you accuse us of dumbing down. Look at this. Just how about answering one of these questions?
Well, now it's my turn to pick a show, Ian. And in the grand tradition of what we just watched, I think you will guess what the show is straight away. So maybe if you could describe what you're seeing, that would be good. Also, when the titles are finished, I'm just going to let the action run for about 30 seconds and during that sequence, I would like you to describe in great detail what we're seeing.
Okay. Very intrigued.
So, here we go.
Oh, well...
What are we seeing?
Screws have been tightened, wood has been cut.
We saw a cheese grater spinning round.
And here are some eggs, because this is the great egg race, isn't it?
It is the great egg race. How does that make you feel?
Excited.
I'm pleased to hear that.
I love this piece of music.
So now the credits are ending. Now, Ian, I want you to tell me what we're seeing.
It's an articulated lorry being driven through... Oh, it's BBC TV lorry.
Yes.
Being driven through a rather sort of deserted...
We're seeing it from a helicopter.
Yeah.
And what's on the roof of the lorry?
It says, the Great Egg Race.
Well, now we're seeing a Great Egg Race convoy, Ian.
It's something being escorted...
Well,
to a location.
Well, as you can see, it's very intriguing. So now we're going to watch The Great Egg Race. So we've just watched an edition of The Great Egg Race, which was first broadcast on BBC Two on Tuesday, the 5th of June, 1984. At what time, Ian?
Oh, now there's a question. Mm. I'm guessing... Early evening.
Early evening.
Probably not 6 p.m. A bit later, maybe.
Have a guess.
7:10.
Oh, Ian, so close. 5 minutes out. 7:15.
Oh, well, I was groping towards the answer. I remember it being sort of after tea time.
Oh, absolutely. So we mentioned when we were watching the opening titles that they were on location this week. Where were they?
They were in Germany, West Germany.
Yes.
Because as our dear friend Heinz
yes.
stated, the programme has spread its wings
yes.
this week and it's gone to what we presumed while we were watching it to be one of the British military bases or settlements in West Germany.
It's actually NATO joint headquarters at Rheinbach near the towns of Dusseldorf and Mönchengladbach.
Oh, I missed that. So it's NATO premises.
Well, what I absolutely love about this is it's 1984. It's the height of the Cold War. World War III could break out at any moment. And NATO have just decided they're going to open their doors for 2 days to the BBC and Professor Heinzel. So my first question to you, Ian, is if this programme was happening now, do you think it would be called The Great British Egg Race?
Oh, absolutely, without a question.
Well, it's kind of obligatory now, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, Ian, did you enjoy that edition
absolutely.
Of The Great Egg Race? It was
yes.
fantastic, wasn't it?
I think it took a little bit of time to get going.
Mm.
But once I'd got the sense of the pace of the programme,
yeah.
I settled into it and appreciated it more.
I was really pleasantly surprised because I came to it kind of with this memory of I really enjoyed it at the time and, you know, it's a cult show, for want of a better term. But I kind of had this memory of there were kind of quite a lot of boring bits. There weren't quite as many boring bits as I was expecting.
No, I think there is a laudable attempt to keep the interest up.
Yeah.
We don't spend all of our time loitering by the contestants and watching them puzzle over this.
Well, that's what I remembered. I remember kind of quite a lot of people with beards sort of scratching their heads and sort of toting set squares.
Right, so what do we want to do then?
We're going to put a pedal on the front of the back.
On the back?
We're going to put it on the back.
There wasn't quite as much of that as I recalled.
No, but let's be clear, it is a very male, macho programme.
Yeah.
Coming down from the back as a means of propulsion. The same on the front here.
Something
some form of buoyancy.
Or even further out, in fact.
We really need to talk about what the challenge is this week. And I think this is probably the quintessential egg race challenge, isn't it? I can't think of a more egg race task for them to do.
Each team will have a bicycle. Tomorrow morning, you'll find yourself standing at the edge of a swimming pool full of water. In the meantime, we'd expect you to make some minor modifications of the bicycle to enable one team member wearing a wetsuit to ride it across a swimming pool.
It's such a great idea because for anyone watching, the idea of trying to cross a swimming pool by any other means other than swimming is instantly graspable.
Yeah.
And has, you can immediately start imagining
yeah.
what sort of things could go wrong and how they might try and do it.
Well, what it calls to mind is, and I think this is true of a lot of Egwith, it's basically that whole notion of those magnificent men in their flying machines, isn't it? These kind of incredible, elaborate Heath Robinson contraptions. It's kind of hugely entertaining.
You want and expect to see devices which are as elaborate and convoluted as possible, and you'd be disappointed if you didn't.
Yeah.
But thankfully, in this particular episode, you do see extremely convoluted.
Absolutely. And without wanting to get too technical about it, what's great about this challenge is that there are two elements in it, in that you have to make a vehicle which is buoyant and which can be propelled through the water in an efficient fashion so you get to the other end of the pool. So in that sense, it's doubly difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, because I was thinking, oh, well, it should be fairly straightforward to adjust a bike or augment a bike to make it float.
It's tantalisingly simple, isn't it?
But then, as you say, that's only half of the puzzle. Mm. You then have to try and make it move. And watching them grapple with that and arrive at very different methods, not always successful, helped really to drive the programme along.
Yeah.
Our teams here in Germany are all from forces serving in the area. The green team is from the 2-5 Engineer Regiment of the Royal Engineers.
We've got the yellow team, who are the 4-3-1 maintenance unit of the RAF.
And finally, the red team is from Rimi Force Armour Division.
So they're all based in this hangar, and they've all got their own individual workstations. Now, Ian, I think you really like those workstations. Perhaps you could elaborate.
Well, I was impressed by the amount of detail and attention that had gone into this.
Yeah.
That's obviously why the BBC had to employ a convoy of vehicles to transport all this stuff over to Germany. It's done very properly. It's not just, like, thrown together. They're sort of in these, like, alcoves, aren't they? With
Great! I love the alcoves
and colour coordinated.
Oh yeah, and they've got a little kind of they've got a little sketch pad. They've got a workbench. They've all got the same sort of set of tools to work with.
But the one thing that's missing, I think, from all of that is a sense of character and who these people.
We never get introduced to any of them, and in a sense, it doesn't really matter. But in another sense, it kind of feels like we're at a party and we haven't been introduced to the guests.
It's a little bit rude at times, the way that we are shown Heinz talking to people. He doesn't call them by their names. So you think, well, does Heinz even know who these people are?
You could have made a very elegant paddle wheel here.
Thank you.
This is going to be with actually half immersed in water.
That's right. The ideal is to have the water covering half of it.
Yes.
Should we talk a bit about Heinz as a presenter?
Yes.
Should we give him his full title? He's Professor Heinz Wolf of Brunel University. I think that's important to get that in there. He's fantastic, isn't he? He is what you want and what you need for this show.
He's unique. I don't think there is anybody else or was anyone else like him on television. And part of the programme's appeal was obviously the fact that he was on it. He was this unlikely star.
He's a boffin, isn't he? He's a boffin. And he plays up to his innate boffinness.
Well, it also seems to me rather critical of where the water level is. If the water level is too low, as is here, then the paddles will only be acting over a relatively short part of the revolution.
And what's great about him is that when he's chatting to the competitors about their plans and their blueprints, he knows what questions to ask and he knows what they need to do in order to create, you know, the successful vehicle.
Yeah, there's no sense that he is a pretender or he's playing a role.
Yeah.
You trust what he says, and a bit like Gordon Burns on The Krypton Factor, he keeps the chit-chat to a minimum.
Yeah.
And thereby establishes a little bit of a distance between himself and the contestants.
Absolutely, but he's not stern, he's not formidable, he's just got this kind of innate authority. Now let's talk about Heinz's guest judge.
Mr. Peter Schiller of Dorney Systems, a German aerospace company.
Now, how best to describe Peter Schiller?
Yes, they have got 4 drums of 25 litres and a big block of polystyrene, which is of light weight, to achieve the buoyancy that corresponds altogether to 300 kilograms of water.
Because he sounds exactly like Heinz.
Oh, so he's like another Heinz.
Exactly.
Two Heinzes.
But I love the fact that they're quite happy to go with that. They've got kind of almost two twin judges.
That's true, actually, yes. I was wondering whether to describe him as complimenting Hines or bringing something new to Braga. He doesn't. He just brings exactly the same thing as Hines.
I love that, actually. I love that the show had the confidence to do that. Because, you know, other shows might have kind of had a production meeting thinking, oh, well, Peter's a bit too much like Hines. Well, they just went with it.
A litre of water, 1cc is 1 gram. 100 kilograms of displacement there.
So I think we touched on it earlier about this kind of verite style of The Great Egg Race, in that we get sequences just of the teams working away in their alcoves. I mean, how did you find that?
It takes a little bit of getting used to, because for most of those sequences, all you hear is silence broken by occasional sounds of wood being sawn,
yes.
Nails being hammered.
Yeah.
And it's unusual to have that on television and to discover that and to have to sit through that kind of experience, I think.
It's quite good in that it kind of immerses you in the action, so to speak. One thing that we never get, there's no clocks, there's no real sense of how much time has passed. Sometimes you'll get a shot of the bike near, you know, the bike's nearing completion, but you know, there's no kind of 1 hour to go moment, is there?
No, and we're
does that matter?
Well, we're told that they are against the clock.
Yeah,
aren't they?
But we don't see the clock.
No. It might have been useful to have a bit more of that, I think, just to introduce an element of jeopardy.
Were you doing it now, you would have an on-screen clock, wouldn't you?
Oh,
I don't think it detracts from the show, but as I say, if you're doing it now, you would have to have that, just to orientate you into how long they've got left.
The basis of a whole structure is going to be a rectangular raft, mm-hmm. formed of a wooden frame.
One sort of aid that we do get to their progress is we see their little drawings that they've got on their colour-coded sketch pads. They're not always that helpful, are they?
Well, I suppose as a glimpse into the minds of these boffins, we learn a bit more about their personality. We don't learn it much from anywhere else, but the limited amount that we do see of them and what they speak about, what they draw, you begin to get a sense that these are characters who they know what they want, they're very precise about what they want to get, but they're not always brilliant.
I tend to imagine sharing
that information with others.
I tend to imagine if this was happening now, we would get sort of those drawings would come to life, wouldn't they? They would become sort of 3D animations of the contraptions they were intending to build.
Yeah, it's quite a low energy, sort of low rate.
It's low tech, isn't it?
Low tech, yes, for a programme which is for the most part reveling in technology. Although that does prompt me to think there's no sign here of any sort of computers or electronics. Everything is done with pencils and paper and
yeah, absolutely.
And we see them using a ruler at one point, but that's the limit, isn't it, of the technology.
I do think the programme recognises that they have to break up the sort of the construction process, because we get a couple of sequences, don't we, which kind of act as interludes. One where kind of Heinz is inspecting an amphibious vehicle.
I'm doing my best to make a dignified exit from the Stalwart, which for a long time was a standard amphibious vehicle used by the army, but now in the process of being phased out.
Well, he does more than inspecting. He rides on the roof.
It's brilliant, yes. It's great to see him in action.
He's revelling in it, isn't he?
Well, he's wearing this extravagant hat as well, just for the part.
Well, I think at one point we kind of thought he had a bit of a touch of the First Doctor about him.
Oh, you did say that, yes. Well, I was struck more of John Pertwee in that sort of era of Doctor Who.
What do you think this is, a picnic?
Revelling in
gadgets. Oh, you can imagine UNIT going on the Great Egg Race, can't you?
Oh, God, yes.
Do you think you're doing, Doctor?
And there's this wonderful moment where Heinz interacts with a member of the forces, whom he addresses as Corporal.
Now, Corporal, give me a hand to under the tailgate and show how it's waterproof.
He's very polite, though, isn't he? You
see, he's very fastidious, Heinz. It's kind of it's entirely keeping with this character he's created for himself.
There's someone who I always associate with the programme.
Yeah.
It's Leslie Judd.
Ah, yes.
And I was wondering because we don't see her for quite a while. I was wondering where she was, but then...
And she's actually in that most glamorous of locations, the Pebble Mill Garden.
Last week, I set 8 teams from previous Egg Race programmes a rather unusual challenge.
I think she was a bit annoyed that she didn't get to go to Germany.
I don't know, but this is kind of a little kind of side contest that they've got going on. It's a bit like the Fil Rouge in Jeux Sans Frontières. So what this is, it's a competition to construct the incredible egg machine.
I've asked them over this present series to fill Heinz's breakfast egg cup here with the egg in that nest over there.
And they've brought back, I think it's 8 teams from previous editions of the Great Egg Race. And so who have we got this week, Ian?
We've got members of Reading Borough Council.
Well, it certainly looks sturdy enough to do the job it was built for, Roger. How long did it take you to construct it?
I dust it down.
Okay. Nice and colourful too. So how long did it take you to make it?
About a month of spare time.
And so the premise for this section is that Heinz's breakfast egg, it's in a nest high in a tree, and all these returning teams have to construct a different section of a contraption to bring it safely down and into Heinz's egg cup.
Yeah, I found this a little bit rushed and confused. Maybe, obviously, had I watched the previous episodes, I'd know exactly where it was going. But there's almost enough in that to build a whole episode around, I thought, because I wanted to know more about this extraordinary piece of equipment.
It was the archetypal egg race contraption. It was a bit like Mousetrap, wasn't it?
It was one of those cases where the designer had thought, well, I could just put a couple of pipes in there, but let's put 20 in instead.
Let's have 4 bearings spinning round and going down tubes.
A spiral tube so we can see, rather than just shooting down, we'll have it circle round and round and round for a bit, just because it looks good.
Now, I mentioned earlier that Heinz is a boffin. In fact, everyone on the show is a boffin. I mean, there's no nerds here. Is this show pre-nerd?
I think it is. It's a nerd-free zone. Nerds really haven't become part of... culture.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that's connected to home computers and technology.
Yeah.
Back here, this point in time, if you were interested in this sort of thing, you were, it was your vocation.
The people here are hands-on kind of people, aren't they? Nowadays, it would be kind of computer programmers and software designers.
Yes.
But here, these people are at home with a saw. Yes. They're at home with a drill.
They're happy to get their hands dirty.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's really key to the success, that they can get in there and kind of build these machines that kind of really, in theory, work, as we later see, some of them actually don't. But it's really important that they've got this kind of 3D sensibility, that they can kind of bolt these things together, and it's quite satisfying to see the finished article, isn't it?
Yeah, because you know that it's the product of people who know what they're talking about. It validates the challenge, it gives it an authenticity, and I was also struck by the fact that a number of the contestants look to be. Like they're quite experienced. They're sort of in their 30s, 40s, maybe even their 50s. They're not young people, are they?
Well, I think that speaks to one of my theories about the Great Egg Race. I think this is a great example of dad TV. There's really something of the shed. There's something of the garage about it. Kind of, you know, it's really kind of the whole idea of, you know, dad can fix it.
Yeah, I wonder if there were many kids who were watching it and afterwards would go to dad and say, I want one of those bikes that go on the swimming
pool.
Can you make it?
Dad's sighing, but kind of secretly he's quite excited by the thought
yes.
of it.
Yes, he doesn't like the idea that he's got to do it, but he secretly wishes he had the time and the energy to actually do it and go on, maybe even go on the programme himself.
We have proceeded to this piscatorial location to enable the teams to test their acrobikes. The weather has turned rather more sombre, as I suppose befits the solemnity of the occasion. The 50 yards of shark-infested swimming pool are going to present quite a challenge to the teams, and we've been joined by some fiercely partisan audience who are going to cheer and boo during the performance.
So obviously we come to the grand finale and suddenly we're transported to this outdoor swimming pool. Now, Ian, how would you describe the weather conditions?
Bleak. There's snow on
the
ground.
There's snow on the ground.
It looks absolutely freezing.
Yep.
There's a smattering of spectators who look really pissed off.
I don't think they do. So
I think they do.
They're not pissed off. Are they? They're cheering.
Yeah, but it's that kind of... with sort of songs of praise kind of tune.
Yeah, it's definitely not the kind of weather where you would actually want to fall off your aquabike into the water, is it?
No, and I do feel sorry for them. They don't look well dressed for this particular challenge. Although one of them dons some ludicrous moustache and hat to sort of play at the part of
he's from the RAF team. I kind of wonder. Well, it kind of reminded me a bit of the Russ Abbott character Boggles.
Boggles, my dear fellow, we're so pleased to see your back.
What about my front? What? No.
He's got the flappy white scarf and the big handlebar moustache.
He's the one who, member of the RAF, who, in that particular squad, other people would refer to him always a bit of a joke.
Okay, all ready to start.
And then we come to the race across the swimming pool, and, Ian, it's a bit of an anticlimax.
Yeah, I mean, There's a sense of foreboding beforehand, because when you see these things being built, they look really unwieldy. And
well, I think the winning bike is actually quite good, isn't it? But the other two are really unwieldy.
A certain number of running repairs to the red team. The engineers with their pilot flag are proceeding in spite of the fact that that paddle wheel is not turning.
And so it comes to pass that the RAF bike, he wins by a mile,
easily,
doesn't he?
It's an easy victory.
Yeah. And actually, then he starts showing off.
I went off him at that point. I enjoyed the fact that he'd won it, because it's great to see him succeeding.
It was great because it was a masterpiece of design. Yep. But he really sports it. And so with one of the other competitors, who was really floundering at this point, he went back and shunted them to the finish line. It's like, oh, give it a rest, mate.
Well, I suppose we could argue that there's a certain amount of assistance.
Yeah,
you're just showing
really
off.
You don't need to literally showboat around the pool and make a song and dance of it. Yeah, that soured it a bit for me. And then the third one was poor.
He was basically swimming, really.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
That was a shame, really, because it would have been nice, maybe, if all three of them had been decent.
What you really wanted was like kind of a three-way battle to the finish line, that kind of, and you know, also a photo finish. We didn't get that. In fact, we got a runaway victory because Heinz and Peter awarded the RAF 98 points. out of
unprecedented.
Unprecedented.
Now, this makes the yellow team from the Royal Air Force the winners of this week's egg race. It only remains for me now to thank the participants. First, the teams for their readiness to be cold, wet, and to be baptized by the swimming pool. Minor thanks to the shark for performing so valiantly. Thank you for the audience for their tremendous enthusiasm. And lastly, thank you to Peter for being such a good judge.
Thank you very much.
Come and join us again next week for another and perhaps less wet problem in the Great Egg Race.
One thing about the Great Egg Race is that's it. There's no progression to the semi-finals or the final. You know, you've won. There's no trophy. You just basically won for the glory of winning.
Yeah. There's no consequence to what you've done, other than, I guess, the pleasure in having taken part.
But that's fine, isn't it? It doesn't detract from the show at all. Ian, would you say that the Great Egg Race is a tribute and a testament to British eccentricity and ingenuity?
Pretty much, yes. I'm not sure how this sort of thing would play in other countries.
No, you can't imagine it at all, can you?
It I think at one point Hines uses the word pluck, and that's a very British quality.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The one moment that really summed it up for me was that one of the teams was contemplating cutting a hot water bottle in half to aid buoyancy. Is there anything more British than a hot water bottle to help your aqua bike stay afloat? So 30 years or so on from the Great Egg Race, where have shows like that gone, and what do we have now?
Well, they have vanished pretty much from television. And where once programmes like these showcased people's skills in mechanics and engineering and industry, the equivalent today, I suppose, is shows where people exhibit their skills at cooking and sewing.
Oh, yeah.
They're more sort of hobbies where once people showed off vocations and crafts and trades. By chance, we have both picked programmes that share a similar theme.
Yeah, I think you could call them both brain games.
That is a good description, yes.
And something that they both have in common is that they're trying to bring the application of intelligence into the early evening TV schedules.
Yeah, and doing so through not simply having people sit behind desks to demonstrate that intelligence. They're being given physical challenges.
They're very task-orientated shows, aren't they? I think it's a shame that we used to have early evening schedules which had the Krypton Factor and the Great Egg Race.
And now we've got Eggheads. You've been listening to What We Just Watched from TV Cream, in which we watched an edition of The Krypton Factor from the 20th of September 1982
and The Great Egg Race from the 5th of June 1984. Goodbye.
Goodbye.